Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. For all of human history, the deep ocean has been a source of wonder and terror, an unknown realm that evoked a singular, compelling question. What's down there? Unable to answer this for centuries, people believed the deep was a sinister realm of fiendish creatures and deadly peril. But now, cutting-edge technologies allow scientists and explorers to dive miles beneath the surface, and we're beginning to understand the strange and exotic underworld. Today we're going to be talking with Susan Casey, author most recently of The Underworld, Journeys to the Depths of the Ocean. Susan Casey is author previously of New York Times bestsellers Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins, The Wave, In Pursuit of Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean, and The Devil's Teeth, A True Story of Obsession and Survival Among America's Great White Sharks. She's a National Magazine award-winning journalist whose work has been featured in Esquire, Sports Illustrated, Fortune, Outside, National Geographic, and Best American Science and Nature Writing, Best American Sports Writing, and Best American Magazine Writing Anthologies. She lives in New York and Maui. Susan Casey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're joining us from your, your New York home.
Yes.
But you do, I guess, split time in Maui. I guess, given your subject matter and your fascination, you'd have to have a home on the ocean. So,
yes,
Maui fits that bill. Let me just mention here at the beginning, Susan Casey becoming to Utah. There are a couple of opportunities you can go and see her. March 24th, 7 p.m. at the Natural History Museum of Utah. March 25th at 7 p.m. at the Viridian Event Center in Salt Lake City. And these are part of Natural History Museum of Utah's lecture series. They're free, but you do need to register. Go to the Natural History Museum of Utah's website to register. So I want to start, I guess, with some of your beginnings, Susan Casey. You write that you were always drawn to water. I guess tell me about that. So, I guess, swimming pools and then open water swimming, scuba, etc. And then I'll ask you how you became fascinated with the deep ocean. But first of all, just water and ocean.
Yeah, I'm often asked, when did you become so fascinated with this? And I really can't answer that because I don't remember a time when I wasn't. But I grew up in Ontario, Canada, and so I was around a lot of lakes, not the ocean. And immediately, just anything aquatic would draw my attention. So I became a competitive swimmer and spent a lot of time swimming in pools, had a lot of comfort being in the water, I think more than actually I have on land. And just eventually was drawn to the ocean because that's where it's sort of the big show. Right? If you're interested in water, there are a lot of interesting things going on in the ocean. The stories that I wanted to write about were there. And my background as a swimmer made it possible for me to go into places, you know, that are difficult, where it's maybe a little bit dangerous if you're not that comfortable in the water. And my goal was always to sort of take people along with me, readers, listeners, just to share these incredible adventures.
When did you become fascinated by the deep ocean?
You know, it started when I was reporting my first book, which is about this a neighborhood of great white sharks that were congregating around a group of islands called the Farallones off the coast of California. They're not that far off the coast, about 27 miles. And the water out there is really dark. It's the Pacific Ocean, and you couldn't really see beneath the surface. And there's so much life out there. And of course, there was this group of great white sharks. And so I would be out in this little boat with these scientists, and suddenly this massive great white shark would poke its head through the surface. And we saw everything out there. There are whales, there are seals, the entire food chain is there. And all this stuff would just be popping out of the ocean. And I remember thinking, wow, like when you go through this surface, there's a parallel universe down there, and how big is it and how deep does it go? And so to me, the deep ocean represented all the untold stories and the sort of unsolved mysteries about what we don't know about this planet. So, you know, The Underworld was my fourth book, and it really took all the sort of learning that I and exploration and reporting that I had done on the other books to be able to even think about tackling this because it's just so vast. But of course, it's irresistible because there's just so much going on.
So the ocean,
and we never see it.
Yeah, we never see it. That's right. Yeah, I mean the ocean that I know, that most people know, is the is that very top surface, right? The sunlight zone, right?
Yeah.
So where does deep ocean begin? Tell me about the they're divided into zones. Tell me about those.
Yeah. So if you think of Earth as a biosphere, 98% of it is salt water. So it's just a massive ocean planet. And of that 98% that's salt water, 95% of it is what we consider to be the deep ocean. So that's waters below 600 feet. That's basically where the sunlight ebbs out. And below that, it's a realm that's in darkness 100% of the time. But we think of that as something very distant from us. But in fact, if you consider its prominence in the entire planetary system, it is the planet. And yet it's very difficult for us to go there for all kinds of reasons. We can't breathe down there. There are intense pressures. The deeper you go, the more intense the pressures. And it is expensive to create machines that go down there. It is difficult to access. And so for the longest time, until very recently, we've really lagged in terms of just getting down there and seeing what's down there and understanding how it all works. And we really now are the first people in history that are able to understand, to begin to understand really what's going on and how it runs the entire planet, makes it possible for us to live up here in the sunlight.
The names of these zones kind of give you an understanding of our fears, right? So the abyss, that's an actual zone, right? Even below that, the Hadal zone, referring to Hades, right? So how deep does, I guess, Mariana Trench is the deepest. How deep is that? And tell me about the pressure in an area like that.
So, yes. So below the sunlight layer, the top layer that people typically think of as here's the ocean, 600 feet and below, the first layer is known as the mesopelagic or twilight zone. That's from about 600 feet down to about 3,300 feet. And that is a very densely populated, colorful region with 80% of the animals in there are bioluminescent. So they twinkle and they glow. And there are literally trillions, and some scientists will tell you quadrillions of animals in the twilight zone, most of them very small. Below that is the midnight zone, and that's the vast midwaters from 3,300 feet down to about 10,000 feet. And you see in there larger animals and still quite a bit of bioluminescence. That's the haunt of the giant squid. That's where deep sea sharks hang out. And a lot of these sharks are, you couldn't name them. The average person really hasn't seen sharks that look like this. And all kinds of strange and wonderful life in the darkness. And then below that is the abyssal zone, as you mentioned. And that's from about 10,000 to 20,000 feet, the largest ecosystem on Earth, entirely in the darkness, contains the largest geological features on Earth, including a 40,000-mile seam of volcanic activity where the tectonic plates are pulling apart, hydrothermal vents, volcanoes. There are hundreds of thousands of submarine volcanoes in the deep ocean, and vast rolling plains. The abyss covers 54% of the planet's surface, so it's just enormous. Below that is the deepest realm of the deep ocean called the Hadal Zone, named after Hades, god of the underworld, kingdom of the dead. And that occurs in very specific areas where the tectonic plates are pressing against each other, subducted. One plate is driven beneath the other, and you end up with this very steep trench-shaped area, like if you imagine the Himalayas, but flipped upside down. And the one that people know the most is the Mariana Trench. That Hadal zone ranges from 20,000, almost 36,000 feet. And the deepest spot in the ocean is this place in the Mariana Trench called the Challenger Deep, which is almost 36,000 feet deep. So even though the Hadal zone only takes up about 2% of the ocean's footprint, it accounts for about 45% of the ocean's depth. And that is the realm that's hardest for us to access, because at the bottom of the deepest spot in the ocean, the pressures are 8 tons per square inch. And that's the equivalent of about 300 jumbo jets stacked on your head.
That's amazing. Yeah. Have we been able to go that deep with submersibles?
Yes, yes. In fact, one of the expeditions that I was on opened up that Hadal zone with a very revolutionary submersible that was incredibly successful and highly certified, very rigorously certified. And but still, many more people have been to the International Space Station, to the moon, than have been to the bottom of the Mariana Trench.
That puts me in my mind of something you wrote in your book. You talk about how we're you didn't phrase it this way, but I guess this idea that seems that outer space seems to be sexier to us. It seems to be more, I don't know, accessible to our imagination than the deep ocean.
Yeah. Well, I think that a lot of really intriguing psychological elements come into play. I mean, we navigate the world by vision. We see something, we think about it. We can look up through a telescope. We can see the stars. The idea of going upwards into the light, that's sort of what we're hardwired to do. And I think there's this notion of we want to expand. We want to, maybe we'll go to Mars, we'll have a, you know, we'll get more real estate. I don't know, but it is far more comfortable for us to go upwards than downwards and inwards. And the journey into the deep ocean is obviously a journey into darkness. It's you know, in the Greek mythological terms, it's a katabasis. It's the hero's journey. You go down there, and the only way that we can access that inward journey is with real humility and understanding that we are not setting the rules when we attempt to go there. The deep ocean doesn't negotiate over her pressures. She doesn't. You can go, but only with the utmost respect and caution. And so that's a really unfamiliar turf for us to occupy, is this real humility, but it is where the treasure is. Mm-hmm. In mythology and in real life, like when you go down there, you can never think of the world in the same way if you hadn't seen it, if you hadn't understood that 95%, or at least glimpsed it, that 95% of the planet we live on.
You've described the deep sea as the Earth's haunted basement. That's it's kind of gets into some of those feelings that we have, right?
I guess. Well, I say that in the most affectionate way, because yeah. You know, people think of the deep ocean as they expect it to be spooky, they expect it to be scary, they expect it to be dark, but what they don't expect is the magnificence of it, the mm-hmm. grandeur, the beauty, the gravitas, and the serenity of it.
You talked in your book about two emotions, wonder and fear. And as you went down into this world, you say you think they would cancel each other out, but no, wonder plus fear equals, I can't remember what you said, but they don't cancel each other out.
Well, what you get when you add wonder and fear together is the sublime. Mm-hmm. And the sublime is a philosophical concept that was sort of part of the Romantic era of philosophy. And in the 19th century, one of the philosophers, Edmund Burke, said, described it as, he was describing the Alps, and he said, to look at them fills you with the most agreeable horror. And so the sublime is what happens when you're humbled by the vastness and grandeur of something that you're seeing, and it has to be nature. We can produce magnificent things, overwhelming things, but only nature produces the sublime. And there's this, I keep coming back to this concept of humility, because nothing confers humility better than the ocean in general, but also particularly the deep ocean. And that humility is something that we're, I think, often lacking in our day-to-day lives. And it puts us into the picture with nature. We're part of it. We're not in charge of it. We're part of it. And it is bigger than we are. And you really can't dive into the deep ocean or, you know, as I did in my book, The Wave, go out in 70 and 80 foot waves and think, hey, we're in charge here. Like, we really understand that we are surrounded by forces that are much bigger than we are. And the sublime to me is really rich territory for writing, because it makes human life richer.
Tell me about these experiences. You've been down in submersibles. One, For example, you write about you were free falling for 2.5 hours. I don't know how deep you went in that experience. That's, I mean, I can understand the fear. You, pressure builds and builds, right? And you hope that submersible is built well, and they usually are, right? They take great care for safety. But tell me about that. What's that like?
Well, yes, I knew that submersible was built for the job. And that was the submersible I mentioned previously that was able to go, the first submersible in history that was able to go to full ocean depth repeatedly with a pilot and a passenger. And it was created by a company called Triton Submersibles in, they're from Florida. And I refer to them as the Apple of submersible design. They're just the best. And very meticulously certified by one of the external societies that they bring in to basically, it's like in science peer review. They just watch every single thing that's happening, and it's an external set of eyes that make sure that it's built to withstand these incredible pressures that it will meet. And it was owned by a private individual named Victor Vescovo, who a real adventurous person from Texas, who was astonished to find out that we hadn't been to any of these Hadal trenches, and he wanted to go. So he did it, Victor, he really did it right. And I was in nonfiction reporting, every so often you get really lucky on timing. And I got really lucky because his expeditions coincided with my reporting for this book. And he allowed me to join them. And at a certain point, I asked him if I could dive with him, and he immediately said yes. And so I dived with Victor to 17,000 feet. Of course, the sub goes to 36,000 feet. We dived in my home waters around Hawaii to the base of a volcano off the southern tip of the Big Island in Hawaii, which will one day become the next Hawaiian island. So there's a hot spot in Hawaii that has created the arc, the archipelago of islands. And there is another one brewing beneath the surface called Kemaehua Kanaloa. And very few people have been to the base, only a couple in a Russian sub that goes to 6,000 meters that doesn't dive anymore. But so we were in really in uncharted waters, and that deep dive, yes, we fell for 2.5 hours. To the bottom in Mariana Trench, you fall for 4 hours. So you really get a sense of being deep. And I wanted to bring that experience back and share it with readers in as much detail as I could, because it is truly life altering. Hmm.
I don't know. Do you feel claustrophobic in that? Like a small vehicle, right? Your focus is outside, right? And then there's wonders that you're seeing.
Well, I always tell people, you know, there aren't that many deep submersibles. They're really expensive machines. They need their own motherships. They need their own climate controlled hangars. They need their own teams of engineers. Like for every hour of diving, there's about 3 hours of maintenance just because of the forces that it undergoes. And the environment of the ocean is just hostile to mechanical equipment. Any submersible dive is a revelation, unless you're claustrophobic. Mm. I wouldn't say that claustrophobes would really enjoy it. The sphere that we were sitting in was 5 feet in diameter. It, you know, it's very comfortable. It's the sphere itself. You're always in a sphere because that's the only shape that can distribute the pressures of the deep equally across all angles, which is how the pressures, meet it. And so that sphere was made of like 4-inch thick titanium. It's a perfect sphere. So there's no area that is weaker than any other area. There's no area that gets more pressure and has a chance to buckle. But that, you know, that 5-foot diameter sphere is pretty tight. You have oxygen bottles above your head. We were sitting in very comfortable chairs, but our knees were touching almost. And then there's just gauges and dials and electronic equipment that is used to run the sub is just covers every square inch. So yeah, it's a tight fit. But it really is comfortable. It really wasn't a problem for me. Now I'm 5'4", so that might be different if you're a lot bigger.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about those wonders, right? The just incredible life in these depths. We're talking with Susan Casey, author of several books, most recently The Underworld, Journeys to the Depths of the Ocean. Susan Casey will be appearing as part of the Natural History Museum of Utah's lecture series March 24th at 7 p.m. at the museum, and March 25th, 7 p.m. at the Viridian Event Center. These events are free, but you need to register. So go to the Natural History Museum of Utah's website and click on the events tab. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're talking with Susan Casey, author of several New York Times bestsellers, Voices in the Ocean, The Wave, The Devil's Teeth, and most recently The Underworld, Journeys to the Depths of the Ocean. Susan Casey will appear at the Natural History Museum of Utah's lecture series March 24th at the museum and March 25th at the Viridian Event Center. Go to Natural History Museum of Utah's website to register. Free, but you need to register for those. So, Susan Casey, tell me about some of the life down here. Let me preface this by just quoting you here. You say, every time scientists go out into the deep ocean and sample a tiny area, they come back with specimens, and 92% of them are new species. We're learning more, but there's a lot we don't know. So I guess my question is, like what would we find down there if we went down there?
Well, you know, of course, what we find in the deep ocean are really extraordinary life forms that are different than what we see where we live on land, because they're adapted to live in the darkness 100% of the time in a realm where, you know, there's nowhere to hide a lot of the time. And they're withstanding really frigid temperatures and tremendous pressures. So you see all these crazy looking creatures. I always say to people, if you see marine life and you know what it is, it probably lives in the sunlight layer of the ocean, not the deep. So there are just, everybody's familiar with the fish that with giant teeth and giant eyes, and there's a lot of bioluminescence. A lot of those fish are very tiny. I mean, they look like they're straight out of Nightmare Central casting, but they're adorable because they're just tiny. And there are many, many of them. There are massive organisms called siphonophores that are predators. And what they are creatures that consist of thousands of cloned cells that make up one animal. And they are among the deep ocean's most formidable predators, and they're bioluminescent, so they look like distant galaxies, and some of them can be 150 feet long. There are, as I mentioned earlier, sharks that you would probably recognize as sharks, but you've never seen them before. Giant eyes, really aerodynamic bodies. There is a shark called the goblin shark that's pink. It has a really long nose. It almost looks like a letter opener, and it can project its teeth forward. There are just all these crazy capabilities and body morphologies that we don't see on land. And we know a lot, as you mentioned, we know a lot about the deep ocean, but there's still, it's so vast. I think it's really hard for us to get our head around how vast that we still have so much to learn. And that's before you even get to the microbial life. And the microbial life in the deep ocean is just, it's hard to even put words to how vast it is, but it is the genomic archive of the earth. It's reservoir, it's a very deep reservoir of genomic creativity for hundreds of millions of years. And those microbes, they're alive in a way that we don't think of it as really alive. They're sort of in this nether zone between not alive and alive, but they're there in case conditions change, and then they can come forward onto the stage. It's just this archive of everything the earth has done in terms of creating life. And the deep ocean has taught us more than any other realm in science that the definition of life is more elastic than we realized. Not every creature exists because of energy from the sun, from photosynthesis. There is an entirely different ecosystem that comes from the bottom up, from chemosynthesis, from the minerals and energy and processes within the earth's interior. And that was something we only discovered in 1977. So it's really recent.
Tell me about the Hadal snailfish. This was just fascinating to me.
Yeah, the Hadal snailfish is my favorite animal in the deep ocean. It is the deepest fish, and it can survive up to almost 30,000 feet down. And you'll note that that isn't the full depth of the ocean. No fish to date has evolved to be able to withstand almost 36,000 feet. They have a protein in their cells that acts like scaffolding that holds the cell open and makes sure it doesn't implode, but evolution has only gotten them as deep as 30,000 feet. So if you go to the bottom of the Challenger Deep in the Mariana Trench, you will not see a fish. But the deepest fish is the Hadal snailfish, and it is the most, it's just adorable. It's a pretty sizable fish. Scientists didn't expect to find such a vigorous, fat fish down there. It could be maybe, I don't know, a foot long maximum. It's shaped like a tadpole, has a really big head. And then like a lot of fish in the deep ocean, its body is tapered for hydrodynamics. It doesn't have a tail fin. It looks like a kind of a, like a tadpole. Very large, translucent pectoral fins, little tiny button eyes, and this big mouth. It almost looks like that amphibian called the Axolotl, you know, the one that has a big smiley face and little eyes. But the snailfish is thriving in the deep. It doesn't have any predators. It eats little crustaceans called amphipods, which are very numerous in the deep ocean. They look like sort of commando the shrimp, very tiny, sometimes not that tiny, but most of them are tiny, and they have these claws. And the snailfish is made of this gelatinous material that needs the pressure of the deep ocean to maintain its body shape. And it's a peach, sort of a pinky peach color. It can also be indigo blue, which is a brand new discovery. Nobody knows why, but they can be indigo blue sometimes. But if you have a gelatinous body and you eat something with like claws and teeth, the first thing it will do is eat its way out of your head. So what the snailfish has evolved is two mouths. It has a mouth that acts like a vacuum cleaner to suck in these little crustaceans. And then the second mouth, it crushes them. It's like a mill. And so it looks like this little angelic creature, this little angelic fish, but it's badass. And one of the things that delights me the most about it is here you have the top predator in the most hostile environment on Earth, and it's a pink gummy bear. So I'm a big fan of Hadal snailfish.
And it depends on that pressure to kind of keep its form going. In other words, if you bring it to the surface, it's just a gelatinous goo.
That's right. I saw a snailfish in a baggie. It was just like, here's those black floating dots are its eyes. And yeah, so it needs that. It doesn't have any crushable body cavities that the pressure could crush. It doesn't have a swim bladder. It doesn't even have a fully enclosed skull. And its bones are all demineralized. So while it has a skeleton, it's a teleost fish. It's floppy. Its bones are like kind of almost like the texture of silicon. Yeah, it can melt.
Mm-hmm. So I'm reading about, maybe to have you tell me a bit about this, sharks that live for half a millennium.
That just seems
incredible.
Yeah, that specifically is the Greenland shark, which is a deep sea shark. And if you look online, you can see photographs of them. They look like they're from a different era. Like you could be in the Stone Age when you encounter one of those. And in the Pacific, their analog is called the Pacific sleeper shark. And they are just very long-lived creatures. And one of the ways that they found out that Greenland sharks live that long, they can live, you know, half a millennium, is that when we had atomic bombs go off, there's a signature in their eyeballs. And you can use that almost like the way they count tree rings to know when that flash occurred and go backwards from there to know how long that this creature has been swimming around. So they live in a very cold environment. They're not fast moving, but they're large. And they're pretty formidable predators. One Greenland shark was found to have ingested a polar bear. I mean, probably a polar bear carcass, but still. But they don't move fast. And as I mentioned earlier, like there are different schemes of life in the deep ocean, different temporal ideas of what life is. Microbes are one, the Greenland shark is another. There are sponges that are among the most ancient creatures on Earth, like 10,000 years. They've been here and older. Their skeletons are made of silica, so they're called glass sponges. So we have a whole different range of types of life aside from what we think of when we just think of, I don't know, the life we encounter.
I'd like to return briefly to the technologies. It's been advancing, right? Take me from the first, bathysphere pilots to what we have today. And I guess there are advances going on, I guess, right?
Always, always. I mean, in materials, in understanding of, the environment, like the more we learn, the more we know. But yes, material sciences advances are really important. And the sub that I dived in, the full ocean depth sub, couldn't have existed probably 5 years before it did, because they're just the ways that they can create a machine to withstand these pressures, they need a lot of really high-end technology. And also there are a lot of robots that go into the deep ocean. I think there's something really worthwhile to have human hearts and brains and imaginations down there and bring back those stories. But it's also very efficient to have sensors and automatic autonomous underwater vehicles and robots doing surveys, because it's just, so immense. So we can't be everywhere at once. And budgets are a reality. So the very first people, as you mentioned, to go into the deep ocean was in 1930. Two men went in think of a ship with a Christmas tree ornament hanging off of it on a half mile long cable. And the Christmas tree ornament is a ball made of steel. And they would crawl in this hatch, and they had little viewports that were made of quartz, but those were pretty dicey. But they were the first men to go into the twilight zone, the uppermost layer of the deep ocean, and see the incredible bioluminescence. We don't have that many bioluminescent creatures on land, just fireflies, some worms, some fungi, not many. But in the twilight zone, 80% of the animals there are bioluminescent, and they use that ability to generate their own light for hunting, for mating, for camouflage, for all kinds of different strategies. And when you go down through that zone in a sub, you feel like you're just going through a rain of fireworks. So William Beebe was the man who, he was a naturalist and a really gifted author in the 30s, went down there and came back with all these stories of the amazing creatures that he had seen there. And they got as far as like 3,000 feet down, more or less. And then another 30 years went by where we didn't really have any human exploration of the deep ocean. And in 1960, the U.S. Navy had a vehicle called the Bathyscaphe Trieste that went to the Challenger Deep, the deepest spot in the ocean, with two men, Jacques Picard and Don Walsh, Captain Don Walsh, American submarine captain, who is one of the people that I wrote about in The Underworld and I had the great pleasure to get to know. So they went down there and saw what we think now, we know it wasn't a fish. They thought it was a fish. Was probably a some sort of invertebrate floating, large invertebrate floating away. But it told us that the very depths of the Hadal Zone are not lifeless, which was a scientific theory that persisted for an amazingly long time. Like, how could anything live down there? So they went in 1960, successfully came back. And it was only in 2012 that a third person went down to the Challenger Deep. And that was the film director, James Cameron, who built his own experimental sub. He dived in alone. He successfully made it to the bottom, but he had a lot of mechanical problems and wasn't able to do very much when he got down there. And that sub never dived again. It had a hard time withstanding the pressures. But again, you see, from 2012 to 2019, when Victor Vescovo's sub was made, there were so many advances in materials science that Triton was able to create a sub that could go to the Hadal Zone repeatedly, successfully and safely.
I want to talk briefly about the Titan disaster and what that does to this whole thing. The Titan disaster, if people only have a vague understanding of what's happening, submersibles, etc., they probably have heard about, Titan's implosion. Does that harm the whole movement, or do people understand that that was an outlier?
I think both. I think people do understand. I mean, we all saw the video of what that sub looked like. And if you see any of the other subs, and there are only about six others that can go below 4,000 meters into the abyssal zone in the world, and most of them are owned by nations and militaries, except for Victor's sub. And, you know, you, like I said, you see like the incredible engineering feats that go into making a sub like that when you're in it. And the Titan just looked like very much like I made a plane out of styrofoam and duct tape in my backyard and started selling tickets to take people into the mesosphere, you know? And so everybody in the very small tight-knit world of manned submersible exploration was terrified of this company, this sub, because it was so clear that he wasn't respecting the forces of the deep. It's not, as I mentioned earlier, not up for negotiation what materials you need to use to withstand those pressures. And they used a material that was known to what the phrase in submersibles is called fail catastrophically. What that means is you're okay this second and the next you're gone. And that is just the opposite of what you want. They didn't have any certification, so they didn't have these outside engineering societies looking over their shoulders and you know, making sure that it was safe. And they didn't do the testing because it couldn't withstand the testing. And that sub imploded on its 13th dive. And I mean, when you think of the US Navy's research sub, the Alvin, which I've also dived in, that sub has made more than 5,000 dives with a flawless safety record. There has never been a sub that went into the deep ocean so ill-prepared and ill-advised as the Titan. And it's just a tragedy. It's it was entirely preventable. Everybody begged him not to do it. But I do think that it has affected how people think about subs. And really, it's a shame because they're safe, the most safe mode of transportation we have, actually, aside from the Titan.
By the way, I learned something from the book that, we use these terms interchangeably, but submarine is, you know, you can't go in a submarine to these depths, right? It's not designed for that. Submersible is what we're talking about here. We kind of use the word subs, right?
Yeah, and people do sometimes use the word submarine to, it's a little confusing. But a submarine is kind of more self-sustaining. It doesn't go that deep. It's a cylindrical shape. So it's not, as I mentioned, you really, to go into the deep, you need the sphere for the pressure capsule that is really unbreachable. You're in one atmosphere of pressure and you cannot have that sphere breached. So it's always a sphere. To go to the depths that a submarine, say a military submarine goes to, they can have a cylindrical shape because it's, you know, it's hundreds of feet. It's not thousands of feet or tens of thousands of feet. And they have their own power that they can generate, whereas a submersible needs a mothership. It needs to be launched, it needs to be recovered, and then it needs to have maintenance in between. So it relies on battery power to traverse the bottom of the ocean. And when it descends with being slightly negatively buoyant by carrying weights. And then on the bottom, about half of those weights are dropped. And any scuba diver will be familiar with this concept. So that you're neutrally buoyant and you can use what these thrusters, little propellers on the sub to go around, and they only go about two or three knots, so not very fast. And then when you want to ascend, you drop the remaining weights so you're positively buoyant and just float upwards. And so it's a little different than a submarine, which is, you know, using its own power to travel around, sometimes great distances.
Let's take another break, come back with the final segment after that with Susan Casey, author most recently of The Underworld, Journeys to the Depths of the Ocean, and we'll be back following this. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for today is Susan Casey, author most recently of The Underworld, Journeys to the Depths of the Ocean. We're talking about the deep ocean today. Susan Casey will appear as part of the Natural History Museum of Utah's lecture series. So March 24th, 7 p.m. at the museum, and March 25th, 7 p.m. at the Viridian Event Center. And those events are free, but you do need to register. You can register at the Natural History Museum of Utah's website. So, Susan Casey, I want to have you talk broadly about the deep ocean, what it does for the planet, for the climate, for and you know, I so we're hoping to get new medicines. And, you know, give me an overview of what the deep ocean does for us.
Well, it does a lot, obviously, being 95% of the biosphere of Earth. It's the engine that runs the climate. It really, the easiest way I can describe it is it's the motherboard of the planet, and all of the Earth systems that keep everything in balance, that created the environment that allowed us to evolve and flourish. Those are all very interconnected, and they all stem from the deep ocean. Life. I mean, this is a debate that we may never decisively settle, but the preeminent view of how life emerged on Earth is at hydrothermal vents in the deep ocean. And as I mentioned before, we have this 80% of the biomass of the deep ocean is microbial, and those microbes do everything. They run every geochemical cycle, the nitrogen cycle, the phosphorus cycle. There's just this incredible balance that goes on to make Earth habitable for us. When it comes to climate change, there's a reason why the ocean has been the big carbon sink and also the sponge for our excess heat and carbon dioxide from that we've added to the system. It has just gulped down a tremendous amount of that. I don't think that we would be able to survive without that. But yet nobody knows how long it can keep doing that, where if there is, and there probably is, a tipping point. So it's vital that we understand how all these systems work together, that we really ramp up our scientific inquiry about how it all fits together, this incredibly intricate machine, and all the answers to those gazillion-dollar questions, they lie in the deep ocean.
Tell me about threats. One of those I learned from your book is mining. I think there's minerals down there, right? So as technology ramps up, companies want to mine. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so deep sea mining does not exist right now on an industrial scale, but it has been a glimmer in the eye of corporations and nations for decades. And we do now have the technology, although it isn't like mining would require any cutting edge technology. It's pretty old technology they would use because they would basically just strip mine the seafloor. The reason that people haven't done it is because it's very expensive, it's very difficult. But now what they are looking at are nodules that form on the abyssal seafloor. They look like little black plums, but they're kind of corrugated, and they aren't just lumps of metal. They're more like corals or trees. They have microbial life, microorganisms, and animals living above them and below them, so they're kind of alive. They're called polymetallic nodules. There are a lot of them, and they have cobalt and nickel, manganese and copper, but mostly what people are after is cobalt and nickel. So they're at about 15,000 feet. They're really quite deep. They represent this more or less untouched ecosystem that we don't know the first thing about. So scientists are, at the same time that entities are wanting to really get in there and scrape, and keep in mind that each of these mine sites would be like 30,000 square miles. So it would be vast areas of the seafloor being completely destroyed. Not just the nodules, but the sediments beneath them, which are alive. So it would be like clear cutting a forest, but taking the top 20 feet of topsoil. So we would be destroying ecosystems. And the problem is that every indication is that this ecosystem, which is the largest on Earth, as I mentioned, is probably doing a lot to keep us alive. And very recent science has discovered that these nodules are actually creating a slight voltage charge that's splitting water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen. So they're actually creating what they call dark oxygen in the ocean, which may be supporting the entire food chain. And like I said, we don't know enough. So scientists have been basically begging for 10 to 30 years of further study before we even consider this. And I believe that we will not do this because it is so self-destructive. I hope I'm right. Because there are other threats in the ocean. Plastic pollution goes all the way down to the Mariana Trench. There are crustaceans called amphipods down at the bottom of the Challenger Deep that have so much plastic in their body that they're not fully organic anymore. And there are all kinds of other threats: pollution, noise pollution, overfishing is a big one, reckless industrial fishing. But deep sea mining really dwarfs that in terms of the scale that it would be if it got going. Right now, 30 plus countries have declared a moratorium to give the scientists the time that they need to study this. And that is actually the realm that you mentioned, where when they study it, 92% of the animals that come up are new species. And sometimes they're more than new species, they're new branches on the tree of life. And those are largely microbial species. But all of these things are keeping the system in balance. And the cobalt and nickel that they would get are not in shortage right now because EV batteries and other technologies that we need to defossilize are moving away from cobalt and nickel. So the people that are gung-ho to mine the deep ocean are typically, or 100% of the time, people that think they can make money on it. And yes, that is something that really, it would be a tragedy beyond words.
Much more we could say, but we're out of time here. We've been talking with Susan Casey, author most recently of The Underworld: Journeys to the Depths of the Ocean. Good news, you'll have opportunity to hear more from Susan Casey. She's appearing as part of the Natural History Museum of Utah's lecture series, March 24th, 7 p.m. at the museum, March 25th, 7 p.m. at the Viridian Event Center. Those events are free, but you do need to register. You go to Natural History Museum of Utah's website to do that. Susan Casey, so great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
It's the Beehive Archive on Utah Public Radio. I'm Megan Weiss. How did a Jewish Ukrainian violin player become one of Utah's most beloved local celebrities? Learn about the life of one extraordinary man after this.
I'm Jody Graham, Director of Utah Humanities. Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by Utah Humanities, with the generous support of the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation. We are proud to partner with community organizations to tell Utah stories and hope you will tune in each week for the Beehive Archive.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. Eugene Jeleznik, skillfully riffing his violin, wearing one of his 37 sparkling dinner jackets, was a familiar sight on Utah television in the late 20th century. Not just a local celebrity, Jeleznik was a well-networked producer who helped Utah's music scene flourish. Born in 1914 in what is today Ukraine, Jeleznik and his family fled the Bolshevik Revolution to New York City. There, he honed his violin skills and gained a reputation for his skill playing Russian folk tunes. In the early days of television, Jeleznik was scouted by the National Broadcasting Company to perform in one of their first televised orchestras. When touring through Salt Lake City in the late 1930s, Jeleznik met Virginia Washburn, who had become his wife of 54 years. Soon after moving to Utah, he was hired as the music producer for the local NBC affiliate, KDYL, which was the only television station between St. Louis and Los Angeles. Television was so new at the time that only about 700 Utah homes owned TV sets. During the 1950s and 60s, Jeleznik served on 19 trips with the United Service Organizations, known as the USO, providing entertainment to American troops during the Korean and Vietnam Wars. When he was not traveling the world, he was working with businesses like Salt Lake Cinegrill Restaurant to introduce music to Utah's dining culture, since locals at the time considered live entertainment in restaurants a bit risque. Using his national connections, Jeleznik also put Utah on the map for touring musicians. His celebrity concert series brought big names like Frank Sinatra to the Utah fairgrounds and high school auditoriums. Now that television was gaining popularity, Jeleznik hosted shows on several local stations, interviewing prominent figures like John F. Kennedy and Jerry Lewis. But his most beloved program was the Talent Showcase, which aired in Utah from 1955 to 1986. This popular show gave the stage to rising local stars from across Utah, such as the Osmond family. A quintessential local celebrity, Eugene Jeleznik was a talented performer and showman whose work shined the spotlight and lifted up others in the name of making Utah more musical. Find sources and past episodes of the Beehive Archive at utahhumanities.org. for the Beehive Archive, a production of Utah Humanities. I'm Megan Weiss.